To see examples of what we talked about on the show, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Hello, you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast in No Direction. I'm Don Moore, and sitting across from me is someone that constantly brings up it is a whole world that doesn't exist anymore. I'm talking about Mr. Al Val.
Al Morbius Val. From parts unknown. From parts unknown. That's what we're broadcasting from parts unknown. We know where it is, but you don't know where it is. Yes, the world has changed. The comic book world, every part of the world, is changing too fast, don't
you
think?
It's always changing. Yeah, but I still remember as a kid in the early 60s, I'd hear my grandfather and some of his friends, and they'd always say that.
Yeah.
And they didn't like John Lennon either, so.
Neither do you.
I like John Lennon. I feel...
The musician you like.
I like the songs. I liked it. I hate to say it. He needed his ass kicked really bad.
I think he might have gotten that a few times. I think life might have kicked his ass a few times.
It's kind of a defense mechanism. But, you know, I read some of the stuff, especially when he was on all the drugs from the Beatles, you know, later Beatles years. Like, come on, dude.
I know. But anyway, we're here to talk about comics. We can talk about Beetle comics,
we've done that.
So let's talk about comic books. Let's talk about...
No, the first one you got.
Really? Because I haven't read it yet, but okay. Seem to be fascinated by it.
Yeah, set it up a little bit.
Okay, this is issue 2 of Chilling Tales of Sabrina featuring Madame Satan. Madame Satan was an old character from the 40s. Pretty evil comic book from back then. I've seen some of the stories on the Digital Comics Museum. They're pretty rough for its time. It's an interesting looking character. I haven't read this book yet, but this is an old 40s character that they're bringing back. So,
well, I'll tell you.
And that's a Frank Avila cover.
Yeah, and the cover is what catches me, because even though it says Chilling Adventures of Sabrina with the regular logo.
Yeah, a little, but Madame Satan is big.
It's really small in one line, and I thought it was a new book. And the character, I find the design fantastic. And of course, it's Frank Avila, so it's really nice. It's a variant cover, I noticed when I looked inside.
It is a variant cover, yeah.
Which I prefer over the normal one, and that's rare. But I thumbed through it, I didn't read it, but it looks like she's going to be Sabrina's teacher.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I the inside, the artwork is much different, but I liked it.
No, I used to, but I hate to say this because I don't want to bag on people, but I don't like the interior artwork that much. I like the artist, Robert Hack. He's a good artist, but I think it's not something that I like. I mean, I'll keep getting the book.
Did you like it on the first issue?
I liked it better on the first issue.
What changed?
I think some of the drawing is kind of like...
Rushed, you think he's
some of these faces and stuff like that seem to be rushed in half. Like, look at this page. It's not particularly great. It's all like talking heads, which may be what they wanted. And
you're thinking maybe he's not giving you his best work, and I'm guessing it's...
But the thing about it is it's been like 6 months since it's the last one's been, so you would think this thing would be like a masterpiece of art, and it's adequate, but it's not, you know... I mean, I could say some other things too, but I'm not going to, which I'll tell you afterwards, but it's like, I don't know. I mean, I'll keep buying it because I'm supporting this book, but and the cover's nice. The back cover, this cover here, the original cover is real nice. I think he might be better as a cover guy.
Yeah, the cover is nice.
Than an interior guy or whatever. I mean, but then again, I don't know. I see what he's doing. He's doing wash work, and then I don't know if he's adding... If he's adding like watercolors over and stuff like that, but like I said, I'll keep buying it.
Well, you know, it's not the type of artwork that I go for normally. I mean, I looked through it and I thought it was good. You're pointing out some of the problems. I agree with you. Not seeing his other work. He's a good artist. I'm guessing maybe part of it was just maybe he's got other projects or maybe they weren't.
No, who knows? I'm just saying that I don't think the artwork's up to the standards that I've seen from him before. And it's been a long time.
I thumbed through it really quickly, Yeah, I didn't read the book. I just kind of looked at the pictures and saw parts, and it really piqued my interest. And I thought that was neat that, she shows up later, I guess, when they deal with her story, that she's Sabrina's teacher in school. Well, that's kind of neat. It's piqued my interest. But the cover, it's,
The cover's wonderful.
yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. And she is a neat character.
Yeah, even though she doesn't look like this on the inside, she's got like skulls in her eyes or
And she's got
something.
white stripes in her hair.
Yeah, she's got white stripes in her. I think this is like the 40s Madam Satan. I'll find you. I will find some images to put on there. But I mean, it's definitely a good book or
Have you put any
whatever.
stories about her on your Destination Nightmare blog?
I never have. I should. They were kind of weird, though. They were really it seems to me like from what I see them, they were really a cult from like the 1940s. They're really pushing the envelope of children's entertainment or whatever.
That's a question. I was at your blog. I frequent it every once in a while. I really enjoy it. How do you decide what stories to put? Do you just randomly find things? Do you have a
Whatever
plan?
interests me at the time, usually like an artist or a character. And usually it's something that I'm not, well, try not to infringe on a copywritten, but occasionally I do. But it's because I'm trying to, artists that may not be in vogue, for lack of a better word, to bring them back and maybe people like can see them and enjoy it and, all that good stuff. So it's mostly art based, more so than story, character to a certain extent.
Because some of the artists that you publish, like Tom Sutton, I know of,
Yeah.
and you've been publishing a lot of Charlton comic stories. It's what's funny was there was a Jim Aparo story. As soon as you see it, you know it's a Charlton story. Even I love Jim Aparo, but it looks a lot different than his DC work. I mean, one, he was distinct from everybody. His DC work, you could tell it was Jim Aparo. But this one, it looked more like some of the Tom Sutton work I saw, how it was laid out and put together. We always talked about house styles. Marvel had a house style that was based off Jack Kirby and later John Romita. But everybody had one. But I was just surprised. I can pick most of the Charlton stories out immediately as soon as I see them. But I started thinking, well, how Al chooses these things, because you cover a vast array of the Golden Age and some of that stuff.
The Apero stuff,
Yeah,
I like it, number one.
I do
And
too.
number two, whenever I look at the stats, it seems like a lot of people, must be some people must be really into Apero, because it seems like whenever I put an Apero story, I get a lot more hits on that story than I do on other ones. So I'm go, okay, well, keep it going if I can find them, whenever I find the Apero, and I really like it. I think his stuff for Charlton was a little more. I don't know if the word is cartoony, but it was a little more light, maybe in a lot of ways. When we went to DC, it was almost like he was doing a Neil Adams kind of thing or whatever, because that was what was big back then. They may have even said, hey, can you draw a little bit more like Neil Adams? Like when you went to Marvel, they would tell you, can you do a little like a Kirby thing or, they did maybe Lynette,
Well,
do
Neil
Neil
Adams always
Adams.
brings up that Aparo based his whole career off Neil Adams' Batman. I always thought that. It's kind of funny because I liked Aparo's Batman better than Neil Adams' Batman.
No, I always like Neil.
I did.
I always like Neil as a matter of fact. But anyway, I think Aparo's career was more, to me anyway, even though he did a lot of Batman, was made more on Spectre.
Oh, absolutely.
Those screwed up stories from
Yeah, but
like.
man, he did so many. I loved his Brave and the Bold. I loved the Spectre stories. I liked his Phantom Stranger stories. He was unique, and I was like, we talked about way back, we were surprised that he'd be considered an underrated artist. But I'm glad to know that you're getting a lot of hits on Aparo stories, because that just tells me there's a lot of smart people on the internet.
And you know what? Yeah. And you know what was interesting too is that he always penciled, inked, and usually
Lettered.
inked and lettered his own stuff. So he was like a triple threat. He could do it all in,
And
one month, and do it
do
well. Yeah. So I mean, the guy was definitely like, I can't say he's forgotten because, like I said, people do click on the my blog whenever I put a story, but he's not considered highly as much as I think he should have been, probably because his work got a little more, I don't know, cartoony as the years went along, but still, he was still popular because I remember he did that. Remember, like in the late 80s, A Death in the Family, when they killed
Yeah,
Robin. That was a Perro.
I didn't read those, but I remember when those were coming out.
Yeah. And speaking of Adams, I found these.
But he was being inked by somebody by that time, I think.
He was inked by Mike DiCarlo or
Yeah.
somebody like that. And speaking of Adams, I found there's about four of these. I found them at a bookstore like 10, 15 years ago. And they're British Batman reprints, but they're reprinted in black and white. And that's where you can see how wonderful Neil Adams's art was when he used to do it with pen and ink and brush as opposed to marker or whatever. I love these, man. These are Brave and the Bold stories that he did back in the early 70s, late 60s. I really love these. And I think that, this was probably from like, this is probably my favorite Batman stuff. More so than the 50s, 40s, 30s. I love these Adams because I remember when I saw him as a kid, it was so different from everything else. I was like, wow, this guy really draws realistic. Even though, yeah, technically he draws realistic, but he draws more like advertising, realistic as opposed to,
Well, those were really. I remember when those were coming out because I love Batman. The stuff I liked was the old 40s and 50s stories I'd read in reprints. But when I'd read his Batman, it was kind of threatening. He looked scary and he looked real, and they were making the stories real street level and hardcore. I'm reading them now and kind of silly. It's basically a guy that can do whatever he wants and doesn't have to abide by the law. And like there's one where Commissioner Gordon is, some other guy, another guy looks like Commissioner Gordon. I guess he's a politician. He said, "I'd like to get in the same room with that guy. He can't be flaunting this." And then all of a sudden, Batman's right behind him, goes, boo. And the guy jumps and runs out of the office, and then Commissioner Gordon's laughing. I'm thinking, yeah, that's just how life is, And Batman showing up with guys with a gun, kicking the guns out, and beating the living hell out of them. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, it's not, I don't know. I guess looking at the eyes of a 50-year-old, I'm thinking, ah, you can't really be like that, dude, But
Yeah, I know,
when I was reading them as a kid, they were fantastic. One of those stories in there was from World's Finest. It was Batman and Superman had the Batman and Superman Revenge Squad. I read that in color, and I didn't realize Neil Adams drew that one.
yeah, he I remember him in the 60s doing covers. And then I think the first time I saw his work was it was either one of House of Mystery or one of the horror books. And then I saw the Batman stuff, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is unbelievable!" And then where I saw his work early too was in for Warren, for Creepy and Eerie. He did a few really cool stories, and he was Curse of the Vampire was one. I remember it was done in washes, and it was like unbelievable, And then there was another one where they went back in time, and I remember the cover. Was a Frazetta cover of these cavemen coming at you, and it was all in brown tones. And then the inside was a really like extra long story for them about going back in time. And I just remember, wow, this is like more sophisticated looking than some of these other people. It was like, this is really like all this beautiful line work and the shading and all that. This is like really advanced stuff. And he was an advertising artist, so he came from that, side of the world, and then he was a comic fan too. So he revolutionized things back in the late 60s, early 70s, definitely for
Yeah,
sure,
he pushed them. He pushed them. He did change a lot of things. One thing, he understood the business. He understood how rights worked. He was really fighting for creators' rights. He was fighting for Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. He got that. And somebody had asked, why didn't he fight for Bill Finger? Because Bill Finger, and he said, well, Bill Finger didn't really care. I mean, he didn't say it ugly. He just basically said sympathetically that it wasn't important to Bill Finger. And he says, he didn't do it for Jerry Siegel. He did it for Joe Shuster.
Yeah, I didn't like one of them.
And he said, Jerry Siegel was just kind of irritating and this and that. He says, but he just absolutely loved Joe Shuster, and he appreciated the work he did, and he needed help. But he helped Joe Simon over the Captain America thing. I don't know. He did a lot of things, and he was a good artist.
Great artist. My opinion, anyway.
Well, it's a lot of people's opinion. Usually, when you talk about comic art, Neil Adams is at the top or close to the top, usually at the top.
Definitely. Okay, what else? What else was I looking at this week? Oh, this Weird Love number six. This is a great book. I mean, the stories in here are so bizarre. There's one about a guy who plays like a he plays like a werewolf character on a TV show, and his wife's embarrassed for him. There's one about I was a child bride. That's the spanking one or whatever, where she's like, well, she married this guy, she's only 17, and he's getting mad because she's like, everything he does, she compares him to her dad or whatever, you know. And then there's like,
Ooh.
yeah, it's like, oh, my dad, you know, well, you know, it's like, you know, well, my dad, I don't know if my dad would think that that's great. And the guy's getting mad at her, he wants a divorce her or whatever, you know, all these weird.
Well, don't marry somebody so young.
Well, that's why it was called That Was a Child Bride or whatever. I haven't read this one, but it says stay away from married men.
Good, that's good advice. Or
Oh,
married women.
this one is a classic one here. Isabel's invention, the handhold. This woman invents this device because I guess her husband's kind of like a flirt. She invents this device, so whenever he's flirting, it like she can hear him on the wristwatch while he's talking, and it's like a rope that pulls him back to her. And she's like, it doesn't say who the writer is. I don't think it does, but it's like, no, it just says that. But it's definitely a Charlton story. But these things. This is a great book. It's like 48 pages for $3.99 on some strange, weird romance stories
Yeah,
or
the title
whatever.
Weird Love is
It's
absolutely right.
fitting.
They're fun stories, but they're just so ridiculous. But yeah,
Yeah,
and the
well,
cover is a man spanking his child bride,
yeah,
and
this is just like, you
I
know. Oh, God. And let's see what else. Okay, well. I was going through some paperbacks and I found this one here that I think I got at Wilson's actually, like a year ago or whatever. And then I remember, I don't know, did you ever go out to like bookstores and buy cover paperbacks for covers and stuff like
Yeah,
that? We
and
used to do that all the
they're all
time.
Frazetta.
Jones,
Yeah, there you go.
Jones,
I
Frazetta.
had a Roy Crinkle's The Eternal Savage by
Yeah.
him, but this at one point I thought I wanted to collect Frazetta work, and this is before the Ballantine books came out, the Art of Frank Frazetta. So I'd go to the grocery store and I'd buy like Edgar Rice Burroughs, The Moon Men,
Yeah,
and Dad
yeah,
would see that cover. So I didn't know Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote stories like that. And but we all, me and all my friends, we had a little collection of paperback books because we were trying to get Frazetta stuff. And then that all ended when The Art of Frank Frazetta came out, and I thought, why am I getting little books for $1.25 when I
when
get the whole
I
thing?
can get the whole thing for $5. Well, this is a really interesting, good book. It's called Jeffrey Jones, A Definitive Reference. This is like a guide to all. You know, covers he did, comics that he did, portfolios, short stories or whatever. So it's like, I mean, it's really nice as a reference. The art's kind of small, but you know, one of my favorite all-time
You know
comic book
that I'm
guys.
thumbing through that when I came in here, I started reading everything I'll put on the table. I love Jeff Jones, and that book is fantastic and disappointing all rolled into one. I guess it's fantastic because you see the scope of the work he did from the early days all the way up. And I mean, Jeff Jones, you never stop being good, and that's the highest praise I give anybody. He wasn't trying to work, well, in the early days, he was, kind of following some cartoonists that he liked,
Yeah. He's definitely Frazetta influenced.
as everybody does,
Yeah.
But man, he broke away from that fast, and he was his own person. Fantastic work. My favorite Jones work has always been Idle. And,
Yeah.
but I guess what I was disappointed at was that I was expecting more of an illustration book where they have all these big
It's
illustrations.
more of a reference book,
Yeah, it's
yeah.
absolutely what you said. It's a catalog. And nevertheless, it's a big, huge, thick book. And it's just packed. A lot of information. It has a photo of him at a comic and art convention when he was a kid with Archie Gilblin. And I've seen that picture before. There's a lot of famous people in that picture.
And this is interesting in how much photography he took for the pages or whatever. Here's a panel of Kaluta. Now, I remember the story for a Skywall story, and there it is right there.
Well, you did say in an older episode that Louise Jones said that his work really really
change when he did the
improved.
photo reference. Yeah, I didn't realize he did so much. I was reading an interview with Jones, I mean with the Wrights, and he was talking about how he had like a big old camera setup and stuff like that. So I'm sure he photographed the covers, but I didn't realize he went out of his way like that to photograph comic book panels. Like there's another panel there, and he would get like Wrightson and Kaluta, and it looks like Rick Bryan here, and Len Wein, and Dave Armstrong, and like pose them for panels. That's like a lot of work to be like for a comic book panel or whatever. But it does give it that nice. It gives it that like realistic look that you were like, oh wow, this is really different from everybody else. But then you also understand why you didn't see them on a monthly basis usually because they were doing so much, stuff. I mean, Williamson would do stuff like that too. He'd do a lot of photography for his panels, especially something that he didn't like, that he was having problems with. But there
Well,
was
there are
no.
several artists. I know P. Craig Russell. I've read about him, and
He
he's
does a
shown,
lot of
well,
reference.
the Elric work. He had pictures of friends of his posing and acting, and they were acting like some of the characters in Elric, which Craig Russell has a
Realistic style.
sometimes realistic, sometimes it's really cartoony, but it's all his own. And I was surprised that of all people, he would use character
Figures
reference.
and models and
And I don't
stuff.
know how if he went to the extent of what Jones has done, where the panels were all set up with a bunch of people.
Some of them, anyway.
I think he was just looking at expressions and lighting.
Lighting, yes, definitely
And
lighting.
Steve Rude uses a lot of
Does
that.
he use a lot of
And
reference photo?
some of the Nexus books they take. I remember Nexus 50. Steve Rude was in his underwear, near briefs, taking pictures of himself in certain poses, like the cover. He was Nexus. He had some other people acting like some of the others, and it just seemed to me like he was just trying to get certain poses to use. He
Yeah,
would
get him
draw them.
right. Yeah, couldn't figure him
And
out.
Alex Ross, the
Yeah, he
painter,
definitely.
he uses I know he uses his dad for a lot of stuff. I think he uses his dad for Superman.
Oh, okay, I
And
know that.
I don't quote me on that, but I know he uses his dad, and I think he uses his dad for the Superman character. But yeah, it's fantastic. I love Jeff Jones.
I'm pulling these out because these are guys. This week I was going back to the roots of my favorite artists from the 70s. You were looking at this one here from Kitchen Sink, a Kaluta sketchbook. I always love anytime it says Mike Kaluta sketchbook, I buy
Yeah,
it. I mean,
actually, when I saw that, I got kind of mad at Al that I come in here and he's got another book that's old that I haven't seen and now I can't get it.
no, you can find it on Amazon, I'm
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah,
This is a
another search.
great book.
It is a nice. Tell us a little bit about that one.
This is a lot of either some of our preliminary sketches and some are finished sketches. This is around from the time of Starstruck and that era. I believe this is from the 90s. Let's see what year is it from. Anyway, I think it's from the 90s. And this is just like the new sketchbooks that have come out, the Kaluta sketches that come out, are very unfinished work, real
Yeah.
preliminary. This has a combination of like covers, it's got color in it. Black and white finish work, which is I think a little bit better than the other ones, even though I really do like the other ones. But it's all types of things. It's paperback covers. It's comic book covers. It's like I said, preliminary sketches and stuff like that. But it's man.
I think the difference in these is when they put that one out, I think they were just trying to show as much of Kaluta as they could. I think the new ones that are coming out, they're larger and thinner.
Yeah.
But I think basically it's a series, and they've got a lot of work, and they can show you more.
Yeah.
At the beginning, there was 2 pages. I was teasing Al, I was going to tear them out. I would never do that, even if he said yes. But
I wouldn't say
there's
yes.
some, yeah, who would? But there's some architecture in there.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever I think of Michael Kaluta, I like his drawings, I love his figure work, and I like how he puts things together. But that's one thing that it was a while back when I started realizing I absolutely love his architecture.
That separates him from a lot of the other
It
guys.
does. It does, but it's some artists you notice the architecture, Winsor McCay and the little Nemo stuff.
Roy Krinkle.
Yeah, and Roy Krinkle, that's another one. But Winsor McCay, I loved his characters. I liked the scenes. They were fantastic. But usually when you talk about the people. This is, you know, even Mobius, when you're talking about the old Little Nemo, he says, I never really appreciated as much as other people, but I always liked his architecture. But in Monica Kaluta's, the architecture is fantastic, but it doesn't make you not think of the other work either. You know, it doesn't overpower it.
No, it's designed right, so it's designed properly, so it works. The thing as a whole works, but the architecture doesn't stand out. It's where it is, and the
Right.
figures are where it is. Yeah, that's comp. He's great at composition
Yeah,
too.
he's still working. It makes me happy. But Michael Kaluta, you have never stopped being good ever.
No, or
You,
great for that matter.
yeah, he's just in. You know, like I got to meet him twice, and he was just absolutely wonderful both times, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I've never met him before. I'd love to. This is another one that I got like in the 90s, I believe. It's called a Frazetta pillow book, and it's a lot of little whimsical
Yeah.
Frazettas, a lot of little imps and girls and stuff like that. But it's all watercolor stuff, and it's just it's a nice little book that I don't that I've never seen before and since. I've seen. This is like right before, like, because he got ill and stuff like that. So I don't know. Anything Frazetta is great Frazetta. Like I said, all these guys, Kaluta, Wrightson, Jones, all that, they all like bowed at the altar of Frazetta.
And rightly so, we all did. I love Frank Frazetta, but I'm looking through that book. All I keep thinking about was they could have put those on packages for toilet paper.
What do you
I
mean?
don't know. It just they're like you said, soft and whimsical. But I don't know. I really didn't. It's good work, but it's just,
I
I
don't
don't
know. I think it's I like it, and I think it's like different or whatever
know.
than the usual sword and sorcery stuff. So I think it's definitely like a different side of his work, as
I'll tell you, that's the thing about him. When you think of Frank Frazetta, you think of the half-naked ladies, you know, that were really big butts and everything, China doll faces. You think of the muscled warriors with the swords and just busting. But there were signs to Frank Frazetta that you never thought about, you know, you never saw. He could draw and do anything he wanted. And I don't know if it's somebody put out a Frazetta comic in the 90s. They used
Yeah,
his.
the guy Glenn Danzig put out some Frazetta books,
Yeah.
like inspired by the
Yeah, they had
artwork.
a Frazetta painting on the cover, and then the inside.
Verotic or something like that. It was that Glenn Danzig guy was in the Misfits, and he was in his own band. He was a
Really?
rock and roll guy. Yeah, Danzig.
But the stories, I never bought the books, but a friend of mine, his son collected Wizard magazine. And I saw one, asked if I could read it because it was an interview with Frank Frazetta, which I had never read in my life. And I guess they were really promoting that book, and Frazetta was talking about it. You know, like I said, it was, I guess, written and drawn by different people inside, but the stories are based off of his paintings, and they used his paintings on the
Yeah.
cover. But one thing Frazetta said, which kind of made me stop and read it three times, he said, concerning the artist, he said, he's very good. He just needs to learn a little restraint. Which is kind of weird to hear Frazetta talk about restraint, because, like I said, you just see nothing but savage fighting and busting out. But it wasn't just all savage fighting. There was thought processes to it. There was restraint
Yeah.
in the stuff. But it's like Jack Kirby. Whenever you think of Jack Kirby, you think of people busting out of the panels, busting in and out. But there was a lot of stuff in between that, you know, it was basically the characters in business suits and, you know, talking to each other. As a matter of fact, the Hernandez brothers in an interview were laughing. I said, we learned restraint from Jack Kirby. And I started laughing because that's the last thing you think about. Nevertheless, the Frazetta Pillow Book, funny title. It's a nice book. But I don't know. If Northern Bathroom Tissues gets tired of using the little girls on it, they can use some of the
That's rude.
Frazetta
That is rude.
covers.
Last but not least, some early Wrightson from fanzines and stuff like that. I love this stuff. Once again, I can see the heavy duty Frazetta influence in this early Wrightson stuff. And it's funny because a lot of this stuff was from 1970, and like 3 years after this, he was doing the most unbelievable line work and fantastic stuff. But this is where it all started from, and those early fanzines like Abyss and oh God, what was the other ones? Abyss is the one that I remember the most, and I'll Be Damned and a few of the other ones. That's When I started going to comic shop, that's the stuff that I was buying because it was the stuff that I'd never seen before. And I was like, oh man, this stuff is amazing.
And that work is earlier than the Bernie Wrightson work I've seen. It's still fantastic, but you're right. In a few more years,
It only like
it's,
two more years, a guy was like this beautiful line work or whatever,
he
you
was
know.
great then, but he just got to,
A lot of these guys got great in a hurry.
yeah, great in a
Kaluta
hurry.
did, all these guys. I mean, because they were all hanging out together and learning tricks from each other and like, you know, doing a lot of work and stuff like that. So I guess after like a few years of doing intensive study on people's work and, you know, stuff like that, you know, they just advanced. Another guy that did that too was like Wally Wood. He was like, if you look at his work from like 1949 or 50, you go like, what is this? And then like 2 years later, he's doing this fantastic stuff for EC, and I'm like, was it when he hooked up with Joe Orlando or something? I don't know, but it was like he picked up on everything quick, you know what
Wow.
I mean? I guess that's the thing too. These guys, you know, were starting out as like, you know, pretty great amateurs, but when they got pro, they picked up all the tricks like real fast. And Wrightson became his line work in like a couple of years became like unsurpassed in the comic books or
Well,
whatever.
that's the thing. If you have to draw, if you get to draw for a living, you improve really quick. That's when I was in high school, I went to a vo-tech for commercial art, and the teacher was just constantly telling us, you have to draw. And he told us a story about one student he had in the past. He says she was the worst in his class, and she couldn't hardly draw anything. He says, I was wondering why she's wasting her time at. But he kept saying she was constantly bringing me drawings and showing me her drawings. And he says, they were, if you saw them now, you'd think, why is she wasting her time here? He says, but she constantly drew, and she was constantly bringing drawings and showing me. And he said, she improved over the time. She graduated from the program. And he said, she went on and says she ended up driving down here in some sky blue Cadillac. She's working for some outfit in Florida, and she was bringing the drawings to show him. Says it's not the same person. And he kept stressing to us, you have got to constantly draw. Which is true. The more you draw, the better you get.
But I gotta
So.
tell you something about that. Yes, it's true. But you know, it's always good to draw a lot and take time off. Because man, I know that if I draw like every day, I keep repeating myself.
Yes, that's.
You gotta really like give it a rest for a while and then come back to it fresh. But yeah, you definitely have to keep it going, or else you know you lose, you know.
Well, the thing is, I guess if you're left to your own devices, you just draw what you like constantly and you get bored with it. But if you're drawing for a living, you have to draw whatever the client needs or whoever you're doing the work for. So whenever you do your own stuff at home, it's even though it's still drawing, it's a different thing. But
Commercial work.
yeah. So, but yeah, you have to keep things going and warming up and changing things up a bit. But yeah, you're right. I do the same thing when I draw. It's kind of the same thing over and over again a lot.
Yeah, I do that too. You know, and then I go, man, I really want to draw, and but I'm repeating myself, but I'm doing so good at repeating myself, you know what I mean? That I just kind of keep going. But oh well, enough of my stuff. You're up next, and let's take a music break because we've already been at this for 35
You
minutes.
got it.
It's not all about you. anywhere, don't wait for it to find you. Gotta love somebody, gotta love someone, just love somebody, just love someone. You gotta love somebody, oh yeah. Gotta love somebody, love somebody, gotta love someone.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was Steve Robinson and Ned Battelle from their new CD Cycle, and the name of the song is Love Somebody.
Good record, great record.
Yeah, it is.
Glad
really
to
great.
Play it.
Yeah, every other song, you know, Steve sings one, Ed sings one. You know,
sometimes they...
Yeah, it goes back and forth.
Like Winter Sleeping, they're both in that song. That's a real good one.
Yeah, that's... Okay, that's what I was going to say. When I was listening to it, there's 13 songs in the CD. Steve, it hasn't actually been released yet. Steve gave it to me. I listened in my car. And I like Ed, but I like Steve a little better when he sings. And when he got to Winter Sleeping, that was number 7, and it was Ed singing it. You know, Steve sings some harmonies. Like, my God, that's a great song.
That's a great song,
and
man.
So I told Steve that. And Steve, he says... Same thing, he said, Winter Sleeping is fantastic. And then he kind of looks embarrassed and said they were talking about, you know, not putting it on an album.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I mean, well, I can say that 13 songs, they're all great songs.
Yeah.
And they're all good. And I do like Ed Wattell. But when Winter Sleeping comes up, I'm like, my God, that's... And he sings it well. It's just fantastic.
And then Steve comes in the chorus, in the middle, in the bridge or whatever it is in the middle, and does his part. And then at the end, they're both... are singing same against each other. It's really well. I can't believe they were gonna not put it on.
Well,
there.
The way Steve talks, they have enough material for a second one, so
good.
I guess they were, you know, looking at putting it on. But I can't remember. I think it was somebody in the band Steve had been with, or they'd both been with, and they said, "Oh, are you crazy?" You know. But I mean, the whole thing is fantastic. But we played Love Somebody because Steve's got one of those promotional videos for it. He uses old cartoon footage.
So is Winter Sleeping as well.
Well, yeah, but Love Somebody is the one he put. I guess they released for some announcement. So
okay.
All right. Can I play it? She says, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, we were playing his record for Indie Circuit with Mao.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we played the whole thing almost, like in over 2 episodes or whatever.
Nice.
So, yeah. So now... Back to comic books.
Back to comics.
Well, your turn.
You know, I know everybody's glad that I've covered everything there was to cover for myself with the original Fantastic Four run of the 60s. But I'm back.
Oh, I have that. Yeah, The Lost Adventure. That's the one story where he penciled only half of it or something.
Yeah, it's Marvel put this out in, I think, 2008. I remember reading about it on the internet. I was interested because they said it was an unfinished Jack Kirby story that was never released. And they did release it in Fantastic Four, I think 108.
Yeah, the last one,
and,
right?
I guess John Romita and John Buscema, you know, redrew some of it. Some of the pages remained intact. Some of them were redrawn. And but the story was completely different. And I guess Stan Lee didn't care for the story too much. But anyway, they found it. And whoever was running Marvel at the time, you know, they put it together. They got Ron Frenz to redraw some of the panels. And he really does a good Jack Kirby.
Yeah, he sure does. And I saw Buscema, too, by the way.
Yeah. But anyway, they put the story out. They used a Jack Kirby Fantastic Four drawing. I think it was a poster. And it was really neat. I remember buying that years ago at a store that sold comics. They're mostly a sports card store. And when I got that, the guy at the counter said, well, what do we got here? And so I told him, he goes, well, I don't even know our stock. I need to go look at it. But the book, I guess I got it in 2008. It was good. At the back, they have some of the pages that they, you know, Buscema and Romita had done for it. I didn't really care for it. They got the story redone in the front, the way, I guess, as close to Jack Kirby's original as they could. Then they have pencil pages, which are amazing. Some of the panels aren't there, and they said that some of the panels were lost. I don't know how they were lost.
It looks like this panel wasn't even done.
Yeah. Some of them are blank. And in the story, they cut some of the panels and put them in other places, and then, you know, Ron Frenz drew some bridges. But you can see notes that Jack Kirby's telling Stan Lee what the story is. Reading this book, they basically said that there was, I guess, the second page or third page, Stan Lee said he can't dialogue the page. He doesn't understand what's going on. On the internet, I've seen some people post those pages and complain that it was Stan Lee's ego that decided he was going to let Jack Kirby know. It was supposed to be the 102nd issue. And instead, they used the 103rd issue for the 102nd, which was that, you know, three-part story that Jack Kirby didn't do all of it. But they said, you know, Stan Lee was just letting Jack Kirby know he was the boss. I don't think it was that at all. I think, I'm guessing Jack, you know, Stan Lee didn't really know what was going on and said, we'll just do this later. But I don't know. It was pretty good. I still liked it. I think some of it was different than what Jack Kirby actually intended. They kind of made it another story. But reading what they actually did for 108, it's not a good story at all. They tied it into the negative zone.
Okay.
But it has a visiting professor talking to Jack Kirby, and they have a sculpture of two heads, you know, in one. And basically they're saying that that was their most dangerous foe and it almost ended the world. And I think somewhere in one of the versions, they were basically saying it was Alicia Masters that made it. In another version, I guess they found it and it was an old ruin. But it ended up being two brothers. One of them had all the power. But like I said, the issue 108, there were still two brothers, but one of them had some kind of tie to the negative zone. It's pretty bogus. Anyway.
You can tell from the pencil work that Kirby was getting a little more sketchy with his work. And these, I've seen pencils from like a year or two before and they're a little tighter or whatever. So I'm thinking that probably was so, he was so confident with Joe Sinnott's inking that he just gave him like, you know, somewhat rough work and knowing that it was going to look good or whatever. Either that or he was just, knew he was getting ready to bolt from Marvel. So he just gave him like, you know, whatever they needed. You know, bare essentials, and that's it.
I think it was a little of both. I think I didn't know he was getting more blunt as time went on, you know, with Fantastic Four. And I know Joe Sinnott, I guess he's making a lot of corrections, and after a while he stopped. You know, he was just kind of leaving it. I mean, still being Joe Sinnott and making it better, but you could see it was getting more, that's the best word to put it, blunt. You know, the fingers were more square, you know, everything was. He's getting more comfortable with it. But, I don't know. After I read all those, you and I talked about this a lot, and I found it and read it, and I like it a lot better now having read the entire run.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like that Marvel did that, but, you know, I don't like the story of what happened. It's kind of snarky on everybody on Marvel's part to do what they did.
Originally or no?
Originally, yeah. You know, they should have just taken the story and dead as it was. You know, not like, oh, we don't like this story. We're going to put it on the side.
Yeah,
you know?
It was messed up. It didn't really fit, but I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there was some politics involved. And I'm sure they all knew Kirby was leaving at some point anyway. So maybe some sour grapes, you know. I don't know. So anyway, what else you got, man?
Could be. Well, Al's not gonna like it.
What's that?
But The Shadow, Midnight in Moscow. By
Howard. Oh, is this the latest one?
Yeah.
Is this the end of it? Or?
Yeah, six issues.
Oh.
I think it was put out by Dynamite.
Yeah, Dynamite,
I
yeah.
love Howard Chaykin. When he was doing the American flag work, that's to me when he was really hitting all cylinders. And for DC, he did a 4-issue miniseries about the Shadow, but it was the Shadow in the 80s, and it was really neat because he. I always thought of the Shadow as Lamont Cranston, but I guess there was other names. And in the old DC work, there was a kid's party, and there was a guy that would show up as a Shadow, but he was an old man. And he's basically just like how Lone Ranger would do, store appearances and stuff. But then Lamont Cranston showed up, and he was still a young man. And you kind of find out he was in a place, it's a place like Shangri-La. He showed up with his two grown sons. They were half Chinese. And it was, to me, a fantastic story. I guess they found Lamont Cranston in a plane, and he was half dead. So they worked on him, fixed him up, restored him, and he got married in that Shangri-La type place. Anyway, this is, I guess, is after World War II, either right before World War II or after. And, Howard Chaykin always writes about Russia, I noticed. But this one, they kind of play around with another. I don't know enough about the Shadow to understand these other names he went by. But basically, he's with, is it Margot Lane was the woman he was always with?
Margo,
But they're together, they go to New York, and then from there, they're going on to Moscow. It's a long story, but basically, this story ends with him leaving her and disappearing. And I guess if you really looked at it, that's where he goes to. What happened after that was when he went to that Chinese place and he shows up again in the 80s. I've been buying this, but I don't know why I didn't read it issue by issue when it came out. I just got them. I got all six. When I finally got them, I sat down and read them. It's a nice series.
See, I can see some of the old shaking in some of this, but I mean, I look at some of these panels here, like that face there and that face there, and I'm like, what is that? Who? What? I don't get it. You know,
What do you mean?
they're terrible. Look at that face and that face. They're like off, and like it looks almost like he did it in. Looks like he did it in a hurry. Now the rest of it looks really nice, but I'm seeing like flashes of the
Yeah.
excellent, but I'm also seeing flashes of like I don't know. I mean,
Some of
I
it,
think he's rushing it. That's
yeah.
what I think. And it's based in Russia, so he's definitely rushing it.
Well, he just kind of
But
let some of it
cover's
go.
awesome. No, the cover actually, in the back there's an image of it in black and white. The cover of that one looks better in black and white than when they did all the fancy schmancy coloring on it. You know
Well,
what I
that's
mean?
one thing about. I love Howard Chaykin, and I think the coloring's nice, but it's computerized. But he's doing a lot of the. It looks like what they did airbrush type stuff,
Yeah, Photoshop work, it
and
looks like.
sometimes it's too much,
It's
and
overpowering.
sometimes they make it blurry. Like when it's raining and stuff. And it's just a personal preference. I don't like to see the line work destroyed, and I don't like
That's
to see it over-colored.
exactly right, yeah.
Now, DC published Neil Adams story, Superman versus Muhammad Ali,
Yeah.
and I never got the original one. I bought the big one, and they did the coloring, and again, it was the 3D kind of rendering. What I liked though was that they put the blank plate on top of it, over it. So you had these fan like you always noticed it on Superman because the blue suit had gradients and all, it looked neat. And like I said, you had the black plate over it so it didn't destroy the line work. I don't mind that so much. But yeah, this one sometimes I think the coloring could have been subdued a little bit more, but
Yeah, I mean, obviously, time constraints and having
yeah.
to put the book out on time and whatever. But I can see the old shaking in there in a lot of panels. But some of them, it's like, huh, sounds like it looks like a rush job in here or whatever. But you're right, that coloring is diluting the line work, which is like, what was his strength, I thought
Yeah.
anyway. The really nice, design and line work and stuff like
Well,
that.
he's
So.
doing Satellite Sam for Image.
Yeah.
Which is a book I really like. You bought one or two, I
Yeah, I
think.
did. Those are the only ones I ever saw.
Yeah. I
That was in black and white,
Yeah,
though.
it is a black and white, which you prefer, you've always
For
said.
his work, yeah.
And that one, I think Max Fraction is writing it. And that one, the story's really neat, and the
It's
way
about
he,
television,
yeah,
right?
the
In the
early days of
50s.
television. And it's good. But he was drawing this at the same time. I'm happy he's doing so much
Yeah,
work.
that's what I feel. I'm glad he's doing work,
And
yeah.
some of the, I've seen some of the work he's done in the past, like he did Challenge of the Unknown for DC. I guess it was I'm guessing a limited series. I was so excited in the 90s to read about that. I got the first issue, and I didn't care for it. It didn't seem like he's putting too much in the artwork, and the story didn't really make sense to me. I've heard him in an interview say that, he was really proud of that work. Nobody bought it, and he didn't know why. Well, maybe if I saw the whole series and read it again, but I didn't feel like spending money for something that he didn't seem to put much effort into, in my opinion. This one, I'm happy. I really enjoyed it. You can tell he really likes the Shadow character,
Well, you used to draw for DC.
Yeah, it's nice. Anyway, I'm glad he's doing so much work. I'm glad he's doing artwork instead of just writing stories for other people.
Or for
So,
television.
yeah, that's true. He wrote a lot for television, didn't he?
Flash and stuff like
I
that. Yeah,
remember the
he's a busy
Flash.
guy.
Yeah.
I just don't like the coloring.
But he didn't do the coloring.
He did? No, I thought he did. No, somebody else? Oh,
No, he's got a Jesus Alberto.
okay.
So,
I mean, it's, you know what it is? I don't like it because it takes away from the line work. It's fine coloring. I mean,
yeah.
it is, it's perfect for what he wants to be, but I don't know if that's the perfect match for Chaykin. Even though Chaykin probably likes it because it's very painterly, and it reminds me a little bit of those old Stars My Destination things
Well,
or
the thing
whatever.
is, looking at it, you're right, but it's hot. The colors are very bright and hot.
Yeah.
And when he painted, I mean, even though he used some bright colors, it was subdued somewhat,
A little bit, yeah.
Here, I mean, I see bright cyans, which I love, but in this one, it takes away from it. But,
Hey.
All right, another piece, P. Craig Russell, The Magic Flute.
Yeah.
P. Craig Russell and I'm
Is this more
guessing,
opera stuff?
yeah. Well, The Magic Flute was that Mozart piece.
Okay.
I guess, I don't know if it was in the 70s, late 70s, but in the early 80s, there was a lot of opera work that P. Craig Russell was doing. And he started naming all of his pieces opera number whatever. Which I really liked. But there was some other, he did one story, I think it was Bluebeard or Blackbeard and Adeline or whatever. I'm not an opera follower. But he did The Magic Flute, and they were three square-bound, comic book-sized, full-color pieces. I think Eclipse put them out. Well, I got the first issue of Magic Flute, and I really enjoyed it. And I never saw the other two ever. These came out in, what, I think 1990 or 92. And I was at Wilson's Book World, and like I said, they had a bunch of new comics, and all three issues were in it for a dollar. I think they were $5.95 when they came out. So I bought them, read them. Really nice work. It tells the whole story of I guess the Magic Flute and how it came about. I've got the CD of the Magic Flute. I didn't realize all that was in there. So like I said, I'm not really an opera fan, but I'm happy to finally read the piece.
It hasn't been reprinted as a graphic novel or anything like that.
He's got a Craig Russell's got a Kickstarter for that Bluebeard and Adeline. I guess
Oh, he does, huh?
the color has been lost, and they're trying to get a restored edition of
Hmm.
it. And I don't really know. He's been on the Facebook page posting the same thing where I guess he watercolored it on paper and then put a black overlay of the line work on top, which, it's something I like. But I guess I don't know. I don't really understand exactly what happened to the color, but I guess they have a Kickstarter to finance it, saying get
If
the
you put the
colors right.
watercolor on the paper and he inked over it, how could the color be lost? Unless there's
No.
some stats or something.
He had a, photo piece of the black lines. So they printed the color work, as a four-color process with a black plate on top of it. That's how Bill Watterson did a lot of his covers and, paintings and
So
stuff.
yeah, so he's not actually watercoloring and drawing on the watercolor. It's a separate piece of, okay, that makes sense.
But anyway, he's got a Kickstarter for that. I don't know, the magic, all these things should be, you would think they put out some edition of all of the artwork he did,
It depends on demand too, I mean, it's probably going to be really expensive if he puts it out as a one volume
Because
thing.
he had another series that I think Eclipse put out, but they weren't square bound. They were regular comic books, and they were I can't think of the names of these, but it was another opera, and I think he had three or four different series, and they were like three, four issues each, and they all had different names. And I bought some, but I didn't see all of them. And then at Pat's store, I bought them, and he had a bunch of them bagged together. I found a bunch at Wilson's, and I bought some off an online seller. I really enjoyed that story because it was an opera, but for some reason, it reminded me more of like reading those fantasy books like Conan and stuff like that. He's done a lot of the opera work, and you think they just put out a nice collection of them. But yeah, you're right. I guess demand, but they printed a lot of those books.
That's not that's 1990 though. That was like, 25 years ago. Scary to say that. That's 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's golly. I
Yeah.
know, it's so strange.
Yeah, they look, I mean, the books look like they could have been printed yesterday, but they're 25-year-old books.
Yeah.
It is really weird.
But like I said, Craig Russell, he's one of those artists I buy what he did, He was just one of those artists that I liked, and when I saw it, I snagged it. He's always remained a favorite of mine. So, anyway.
Cool.
And
What's in
well,
your what's left of your in your bag of tricks there?
this is something we always talk about.
Oh yeah.
Alan and I were at the comic store a few weeks ago, and they had a trade paperback from IDW called The Rocketeer by Dave Stevens. And the cover is the famous picture of him on top of a building holding the pistol. I think it's a Luger. And I just always liked it. Basically, this is. It reprints all the work he did for Pacific and Eclipse at the beginning. It has the original Rocketeer story, which is five separate stories. And then it's got the Kimiko work he did with, what was it? He goes to New York.
All right.
Trying to think of what that was called. He meets the Shadow.
Was it Kimiko?
Yeah, Kimiko put it. I can't remember what they called the. Oh. Cliff's New York Adventure.
Oh, okay.
But the original Rocketeer storyline, they're in Hollywood, and then Betty takes off with her photographer and they go to New York. So when the story ended, basically Doc Savage's minions said you can keep the rocket pack and all that. And they're talking to Petey. And they say, well, we gotta go, and they leave. So Petey's going over to tell Cliff everything's okay. And Cliff left him a note and took the bulldog plane and said, I've got to go to New York to stop it. Sorry. I'm sorry about running from the law and everything else. Well, like I said, years later, Kimiko puts it out. I think it was three issues, but he's in New York. And he's basically working for the Shadow. But he never appears as the Shadow. He just appears as, I don't know. I didn't like it as much as the first five, but I still liked it.
Let me see.
It's nice to have it all in one piece. My favorite part of it was it has everything. It has all the ads he illustrated for Pacific Comics. It has all the extra work he did for that graphic novel that Eclipse put out of the original series. It has the covers. It has all the spot illustration work he did, which I don't know, to me, it's like everything he did for the Rocketeer series in one package. And it makes me happy. I saw in the store, I showed it to Al, and he goes, yeah, I've got all the other books. And before I walked out of the store, I bought it. I just can't leave it. I read it, and to me, when I read it, it's like I read it for the first time. It's to me a fantastic package. Even if you have all the separate issues and everything else, get it anyway.
Oh yeah, I remember some of these covers. Some of them, not all. Well, I think I do have all of these.
That was the cover of Amazing Heroes right there, when they were talking about the Rocketeer. I mean, like I said, everything Dave Stevens did for the Rocketeer is in this.
I thought he had done more, but yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, other artists have drawn the Rocketeer
Yeah,
though,
and we've got those. I like the work I did. They stopped doing that, I noticed.
but what?
The Rocketeer books.
Yeah, who was doing them last? I don't even remember.
IDW.
Were they really? I don't
Yeah, they put
know. Are they
this
the ones
up.
that did the assignments? The one where everybody, all the
Yeah.
guys were doing them? Okay.
Yeah, IDW did they did a 4-issue series, The Rocketeer. I remember Alex Ross, that first 4 issues, did the covers, which were neat. And they had variant covers. But the Alex Ross covers were neat. And then they had pinups, and they also had short stories. Michael Kaluta drew a fantastic 4 or 5 page story. But they had different people that did the stories, and there was 4 issues, and it was basically about whatever they wanted in a time period. Some of them, he was fighting World War II and writing letters to Betty. Then did a second book, and I remember Darwin Cook did the 4 illustrations for it, which I thought were really unique. It looked like he was drawing them in Illustrator or something. They were really graphic. And then after that, they started doing miniseries. I remember Walt Simonson did the covers for it. Chris Samnee and Mark Waid, I think, did 4 issues.
Yeah, that's right. I remember those,
And then
yeah.
somebody else did another series. And then they got The Shadow and, no, it was The Spirit and Rocketeer, and Jay Bone drew those.
I remember that one.
Yeah. There was, I don't know, they had the 2 4-issue series of all the, basically everybody doing all their different stories. And they had, I think, three.
They should get together and do like a book with the shadow. The Spirit, the Rocketeer, all these guys
Yeah,
like
Doc
teamed up, or
Savage.
Doc Savage, all these 40s guys, regardless of whether they're teaming up to like fight, the
Well,
Nazis
see,
or
that's what I
whatever.
thought he was going to do. Well, like I said, the Shadow was in that Cliff's New York adventure, but they never said his. I think he had a code name that they used, because Cliff had a friend that was another pilot, and they met up in New York, and he worked for the Shadow, even though he never called him that. And he says, "Cliff, he wants to hire you." And they show the guy, and he had those fantastic eyes, and that big nose and stuff. And he's always in a tuxedo, but as soon as the way Dave Stevens drew him, he just commanded all your attention. And he knew it was the Shadow, Well, it was the first one, it was Doc Savage, but they
Yeah.
never said Doc Savage. You just
Yeah,
saw
that's
his.
right. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. But yeah, it was fun. I wish there was more stories.
I wish they would make more. I'm sure there's plenty of artists that would do them too,
I heard Disney's wanting to, I
Make another
guess,
movie?
yeah.
That'd be a good
I
idea.
love that first movie.
It was good.
It was, I remember he was talking about wanting to do a movie, and they said Disney was going to do it. And like I said, Marvel had a lawsuit against Dave Stevens, kept calling the court over the name Rocketeer.
Why, what was it infringing on?
Because they had a story called, I think, The Three Rocketeers or something like that, and they said they
Oh.
owned the name. That's back when Marvel was really bullying everybody. And I know Dave Stevens was talking about it, and he said that the problem is he has to hire an attorney and spend all of his money. When they go to court, the Marvel attorneys would say, "We need more time to put the court,
Yeah.
And it says it was killing Dave Stevens. He was taking, any kind of work just to pay for this, and they were keeping him tied up in court. And I guess the big joke was that when, Disney took it, Dave Stevens just, I guess Marvel dropped the whole suit, and it says it's basically one big bully out bullying another big bully, Now Disney owns Marvel. But that movie, they changed some things. They didn't put Betty Page in it, which Dave Stevens understood, and they changed it a character called Ginny. They didn't have Doc Savage in it, which, of course, but the one they did, it was still, I never felt shorted. It still had the feel for the characters. And a friend of mine gave me the DVD. I watch it quite a bit. I never get tired of it.
It was a good movie, and like I said, it was a hit, but it was everybody remembers it fondly,
Yeah,
so.
and it was popular. It didn't lose money.
No.
One thing about it, they weren't going to put the helmet. I guess they're just going to give him a different mask or give him a different thing. But Dave Stevens kept saying the helmet is the most. That's part of the character. That's,
Sure.
and they kept saying they can't do it. So Dave Stevens went and hired a sculptor, and together they designed the helmet and he built it and he brought it back to him and says, "Just use this."
Really? So they couldn't make it
And
up, and he ended up
yeah,
doing
of
it.
all people, Disney couldn't do it. But Dave Stevens, when I understand, paid for it out of his pocket. I've heard some writer on Word Balloon, John Suntress interviews, and he was talking about I guess it was a Dave Stevens book. I think it's called Brush of Passion. And they tell the whole story about how he's taking art classes again, and he didn't think he was very good, and just stuff like that. And they said they couldn't put the book down. Well, it's out of print. I can't get it for under a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
But basically, in the book they're talking, he didn't make any money off that movie.
He didn't make any money off the Rocketeer movie.
I don't know exactly how it works, but I've heard some people say, if you give the rights to the movie, make sure you get the money up front. Don't put for future profits. Because
Oh,
no matter what you do,
the accountants will figure a way not to give them money.
and so you never get it because, oh, we haven't made the money for this, we haven't made the money for that. So, but anyway, Disney's wanting to make I guess they're going to make a second one, and that's fine, but I don't know how you're going to outdo that first one because it's just a wonderful piece.
I'm wondering if they do a second one, they're actually going to call her Betty Page and all that kind of stuff, since they've all passed away
And there's a
since.
store. I saw a store a few years ago called Betty Page at the International Plaza, and it has her.
Really?
Yeah, the logo has
You
her.
mean in Disney World?
No. At the International Plaza in Tampa,
Oh, that place. Really?
they have a store, and the sign's Betty Page, but it has her bangs and her eyes, and but that's the logo. And I mean, it's a nice logo, and the store was all like clothes like that. They had the underwear and all the clothes, that kind of
Wow.
stuff she wore.
I
But
don't know. Yeah.
Mal, he loves that band. Can't think of the name all of a sudden. Mika Bomb, and they have a song called Betty Page, and they're singing about her. And he saw it. We were at a convention one time, and he saw they had a little Betty Page bust, and he wanted to buy it so he could meet Mika Bomb and get him to sign it. He knew it because of the Mika Bomb song, but. Betty Page got to be kind of a trademark,
I didn't know a store could do that.
Well, I don't know how it works, but yeah, there's a store called Betty Page. I don't know if it's still around, but it was when my daughter was in college, because we were at the mall and I saw it, and I thought, well, isn't that something? I don't know if it's still
Did
there.
they use her image?
Yeah, the logo, like I said, it has her eyes and her bangs. You know how she always had the
I
bangs.
have to look that up. That's crazy.
Yeah, so.
All right. That's all we got.
That's all we got. Dallas is talking about getting the core four back together, but we're gonna have to wait a little bit, so you're just stuck with Al and myself.
That's right.
Also, if any of you watched the My Comic Shop documentary and you liked it, Anthony Desiato has a podcast where he interviews. I guess it's gonna be 10 episodes, but he says following Comic Shop Wednesday, he's gonna put each podcast out on a Wednesday. The first one, they talked to the owner of the store, and about how he opened it, why he kept it, and why he's, leaving the store. It was fantastic. I highly recommend it. We'll have a link on the blog, but if you've seen the documentary and you liked it, you'll enjoy the podcast just as much.
Cool.
You got anything else?
I'm done.
So I guess that's it. Thanks for listening. In the meantime,
Read
read
more
more comics.
comics.
To find Al's other podcasts, Slow Robot A Go Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops.